Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
All right. So, we were talking about a little history stuff, and then we'll talk about what science is. I switched it around a little bit. I thought it made more sense to talk about the history first somehow. I think this is where we left off, right? Talk about Freud. So, and I mentioned that Freud was doing this. It had actually, Freud had quite a big effect for a time, for a long time. And not just in Europe. I mean, I mentioned meanwhile in Europe, because that's where he lived. Vienna and all. Then he emigrated to UK. It's a crazy, non-scientific, ridiculous idea. But it still was important. And it was different. One of the reasons I want to point it out is that it's different than, say, what was happening in the States and in Canada, where we were talking about, you know, behaviorism, right? This whole idea that you only study the observable, the behavior. There were, however, real scientific things going on in Europe. Piaget, there he is right there. Jean Piaget, who was Swiss. Piaget is a smart guy. This was a guy who had his first scientific publication at the age of 7. That's good. Right? I think I was 23 when I got my first, so that's pretty impressive. Talked about child development. I talked, I think, on the first day about this idea of, you know, little kids not knowing even how they think themselves. You know, you give them the box of Smarties, they shake it up. It's not Smarties, you put marbles in it or something, but the little kid who's, you know, a 3-year-old, 2.5-year-old, will actually, then you pour it out, they get surprised, then you say, what did you think was in the box? And they'll say, Smarties. They'll say, marbles. The 4-year-old will say, Smarties. The same reason that a kid who's like, and Piaget was really into this idea of what's called conservation, right? So he said that little kids couldn't do conservation. So if you have a really small kid, like a 3-year-old, and you ask them, you take 2 glasses, right, and you pour the same amount of liquid in each, but one's taller than the other and thinner, and you say which one has more, they'll say the tall, thin one. Or you take a piece of plasticine, 2 pieces the same size, then you flatten it out. One of them will say which one's bigger, they'll say the one you flattened out. A kid who's 4 years old will say they're the same size, right? So Piaget really was discovering this, which is pretty cool. That's over in Switzerland. Conrad Lorenz was studying imprinting. There's Lorenz. Really animal behavior. You heard about these stories, right? When the birds hatch, the first thing they see, they treat it like it's their mother. And he said this was a special kind of learning. This was something that only happened in birds. It was irreversible. That's pretty cool. And that was different, again, from what's going on in the States. You've got people like Kurler doing insight learning. Insight learning is really quite neat because insight learning, he was taking like chimps and got them in a big tall cage, right? And way up high, there's some bananas. But they can't get up there. There's no way to climb up there. But he leaves like a broomstick in the cage. And it's not through trial and error of just randomly jumping around and finding the bananas. At some point, the chimp grabs the broomstick and just knocks the banana down. Like it had an aha moment. Oh, I see. I just do that. That's pretty cool. It was like the animal was thinking about it. A mental event. Behaviorists don't like mental events. Over in Europe, they're okay with mental events. There's Curler right there. He looks like a very intense man. You get 2 guys that are like kind of goofy and look like they'd be good to hang around with, and then you've got a guy that looks like he probably wasn't a lot of fun. You also have the Gestalt psychologists over in Germany as well. So Gestalt is a German word that means kind of means whole, whole. It means more than that, but that's kind of what it means. It kind of means the whole is more than the sum of its parts. if that makes any sense. So there's what they're studying is perception. And so things like vision especially, and trying to determine questions like, how do you know what an object is? How do you recognize an object? How do you recognize the background from the foreground in a picture? Those are kind of neat questions. And again, they're quite a bit different from the kind of stuff that was being done in North America, which was basically putting pigeons and rats in boxes and having them peck at things or push little bars. Right? So again, looking at mental events. So over in Europe, they're still looking at mental events. Not in North America really at all, except for a few people, and they were sort of thought of by mainstream psychology at the time as being a little wacky. So it's quite different. All these ideas, including, we can throw Freud in there, are quite a bit different from behaviorism. So we've got two sort of separate psychologies happening. You've got to understand that, you know, that this is the 30s, the 40s, the 20s. This is, people weren't, there was no blogging. There was no internet. Long distance phone calls were very hard to do even. So people didn't find out a whole lot about what people in very far away places were doing. Okay? Now, what happens after the war, World War II? And well, during the war, people start studying information theory. So they could break German codes. And you should be happy about that because they broke those codes and then we won the war, so we all aren't, you know. But so the Nazis didn't win. All that was left of the Nazis was Call of Duty World at War and Nazi zombies. So they break in these codes. The way they're doing this is with a rudimentary kind of computer. And they're looking at what's called information theory. And information theory looks at inputs, operations, and outputs, which is kind of like the way you think, right? Stuff gets in there, you do stuff with it, and then something comes out. Again, but the processes inside wouldn't be something a behaviorist would like. Then in the early 50s, then people are starting to think about this. It's been affecting all kinds of things, not just sort of the beginning field of computer science. You're also starting to get people looking at people with, say, brain injuries. And a classic case here is a guy named H.M., who died recently. H.M. had an operation to control his epilepsy in the early 1950s. And he ends up, after the operation, his epilepsy's gone. So it's great. Biggest problem he has, though, is he can't form any new long-term memories. He can only remember things before the operation. Okay? So when you went and talked to H.M., you'd have to introduce yourself to him every single time you met him. If you left the room and came back in, you'd have to introduce yourself to him again. He only had short-term memory, and you'll find out when we talk about this, short-term memory lasts on the order of seconds. So you could actually carry on a conversation with this guy, though. But then he wouldn't remember the conversation. The weird thing was, though, he could learn things, but he'd never remember learning them. So there's a task that used often enough. It's a motor task. It's the test sort of motor ability and learning. And it's something you've never done before. It's what you kind of need. You can't say, we're going to test how well you can throw a baseball, because some people have thrown baseballs before. What you do is you use something called mirror tracing. You look in a mirror, and in the mirror you see a drawing, and it's usually a star. And you're told, stay between the lines. There's one on the outside, one on the inside. And you're told, stay within the lines, but you have to look at the mirror to draw. And that's actually exceedingly hard, because left is right and up is down. We eventually all learn to do it, and we can get pretty good at it, but it is hard. Brenda Milner, who we'll talk about in a second, tried this with H.M. Because at first, when he had his operation, everything was fine, and they thought, hey, he has no memory, he can't learn anything. And she said, wait a second, I bet he can learn something. Let's see how he does with these kind of tasks. He eventually learns how to do mirror tracing, and then she goes away. She comes back the next day. She has to introduce herself to him again. And She has him do mirror tracing, and he's perfect at it the first time. And she says to him, you know, people are really have trouble with this. Why are you so good at this? And he says, I don't know. It just seemed easy. He actually learned how to do it. He just didn't remember, having ever learned it. And what got damaged in him is a small area of a small part of your brain called the hippocampus, a certain area of it called CA1, and you need that to form new long-term memories. It's a tiny little thing. Wow. Seems like there's some important internal mental events going on. We're talking about now different memory systems, long-term and short-term. We've got all this stuff that happens in Europe. We've got information theory. So we get what's called the cognitive revolution. Cognitive just means thinking, right? That's Brenda Milner's work, really. He was one of the real founders here, one of the real pioneers. Brenda is at the Montreal Neurological Institute, and she still is. She's in her 90s, so she only works, she's told me she only works now 6.5 days a week. She's slowing down. She's won everything but a Nobel Prize. She has won a prize that sort of one in four of the people that have won this prize get the next one, and that's the Nobel. So she's got a good chance. She's Canadian, which is great. She immigrated to Canada in 1940 from the UK. She worked with Wilder Penfield, who was one of the important neurosurgeons back in the 30s and 40s, did her PhD with a guy named Donald Hebb. And her and Hebb basically invented the field of cognitive neuroscience. So that was done in Canada, so that's something to be pretty proud of, done in Montreal. I've met Brenda. She's the one on the left. This was probably 2002, I think. I used to teach at the Memorial University of Newfoundland, and we gave her an honorary degree, and I got to hang out with her for a day and a half, which was awesome. So for a day and a half, I'm hanging out with the person. You know, she's like, it's like, it was like hanging out with Bono, except without the glasses and saving the world. You know, like a real rock star, right? Pick her up at the airport, and I'm thinking, I'm going to talk science with this lady for a day and a half. And we're talking a little bit in the car on the way back from the airport, and she's turns out, of course, she's lived in Montreal since 1940, huge Habs fan. Well, huge fandom. She's actually quite short, as you can see there. The night of the big dinner, there's a big dinner, you know, and the president of the university's there and all this stuff, and I actually had a jacket on. I own two jackets. No ties. So we're at this thing, and she says, yeah, take me back to the hotel now, I'm getting kind of tired. You know, she's an older woman, you know, so okay, I'll take her back, no problem. So she says, the next morning, she says, when I go to pick her up, because then that she's going to give her speech, and she says to me, did we win last night? And this is when Montreal was playing Carolina, as your Carolina with the Stanley Cup. And she said, I said, actually, Brenda, we lost 3-2 in overtime. And we were up 2-1 with a minute left. Eric Cole, I hate you. So she said, oh, no, you must be kidding. Tell me Toronto lost. I said, no, they won. She said, we are never to talk hockey again. You are bad luck, Dr. Broadbeck. Very cool woman. Very cool woman. The cognitive revolution then, which really she started along with a few other people, changed all of psychology, the whole thing. It was okay to talk about mental events. It was okay to talk about these kind of things. Because frankly, now there was brain data. You know, it's hard to argue with, oh, this guy had an operation and now part of his memory doesn't work. I guess memory is a special thing. We can talk about internal mental events. Wow. That was quite a thrill for me. Back when I was a fat guy. More recent stuff. Look, today now we're talking about things like PET scans and fMRIs. We're basically able to, in essence, watch people think. With fMRI, it is now possible, functional magnetic resonance imaging, it is now possible, a paper came out in December, where you have a person in an MRI, and you show them a stimulus, it was a word, the word was neuron, But the researchers didn't know what the word was. They were able to read using software off a computer screen what the person was seeing without seeing what they were seeing. This will lead to us being able to watch. So now we're able to watch people see. You do all the processing of visual information back here in your occipital lobe. This will lead now within, of course, it's very low resolution. The resolution is only going to get better. Eventually, there's going to be moving pictures, not just pictures. Within 5 years, the resolution should be good enough, and there should be enough, you know, possibly to do video that will be able to record dreams. The video, not the audio. And then we'll all post them on DreamTube, which is a domain that I've registered already. No, just kidding. I should. With computer stuff, and of course the software and the hardware is what changes this drastically, because that's what's doing, you get the imaging, but then you have to get the processing power to deal with it. And that's jumping, as you know, leaps and bounds, right? We're able also to do modeling of behavior and cognition, and also, you know, and artificial intelligence. And there are artificial intelligence systems. Right now, they don't tend to do things that have a whole lot to do with people, but there are artificial intelligence neural network systems that, for example, run traffic light systems in big cities. That's going to clearly affect psychology. So now, in fact, a lot of things are splitting up in psychology, getting cognitive science, neuroscience, artificial intelligence are somewhat splitting off, just like what happened in biology, right? You know, you got biology, then eventually it splits off into zoology, botany, ecology, ethology, these kind of things. So it's not that uncommon. A lot of old ideas have been sort of resurrected. The ideas of looking at differences between species and learning ability, for the longest time that wasn't done because it was always like, well, it's all just about reinforcement, right? It's all about behaviorism. I could teach any animal anything, and we've now found out, of course, that that's just a crock. Ideas about memory, I talked about how William James, last time I said he invented, he had terms like primary and secondary memory. We talk about short-term and long-term, or implicit and explicit, or episodic and semantic, and I know you don't know what all these things mean, you will, but dividing memory up into separate systems, modules, processes, whatever you want to call them, is an old idea, but it's come back. The idea of development going through stages, I talked about Piaget, that was his idea, then it disappeared. Now it's back again, not quite as strong as Piaget as far as, you know, it's like this, then like this, like this. It's much more gradual, but the idea of stages is becoming popular again. So this, again, one of the reasons you should know a little bit about the history of any discipline you study. I think it's important. Little Canadian content. The nice thing about Canada is we don't need... Some courses you'll find, they'll use the book and it'll say Canadian edition, and then every so often there's a little mention of in Canada. Cool thing about psychology is we don't have to do that because we have all kinds of content in Canada. We're just good at this. Psychology's always been very strong here. I don't know why. It's just dumb luck. The first psychology lab in Canada was founded in 1890 at the University of Toronto by a guy named James Mark Baldwin. He was doing that psychophysics stuff that Wundt was doing. Remember, Wundt starts in 1879, only 11 years later. You've got to realize, in the 1800s, 11 years is not that long a period of time, again, because of travel, because of communications and stuff like that. In 1890, he founds the first psychology lab in Canada, and I believe also the first one in the British Commonwealth at the time. Research in Canada is funded by different federal granting agencies. So this is how your tax dollars pay for the research that's done. See, because like you got to buy equipment, you got to pay people, all this kind of stuff. So research is funded by these three different granting agencies: NSERC, SHRC, and CIHR. Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council. They fund things like, you know, brain stuff, learning, perception, cognition. Note the name. They also, you know, that's the psychology stuff they fund. They also fund things like particle physics, chemistry, biology. SHRC, Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council, they fund things like, you know, the social psychology, you know, like the behavior in groups, personality, development, those kind of things, because it's more sort of social science-y. They also fund, outside of psychology, they fund, of course, things like history and English and that kind of stuff. And then there's CIHR, the Canadian Institutes of Health Research. They fund things that are applied to health things. So, you know, if you're going to be doing something, you do with sort of medicine. And a lot of psychology, of course, is about that. These grants that you get from the government are very hard to get. About somewhere between 10 and 20% of all applications are actually funded, so most of them aren't. And the money actually does not go into the researcher's pocket. It goes into an account at the university, and you have to get all your spending approved and all this stuff. Okay? The good NSERC paid for my computer over there. And this wireless mouse. And other things, other equipment I have. All right? So that's, and it's a small amount of money. Right? Typical psychologist that isn't doing sort of brain work might be getting $15,000 a year. Again, it doesn't go into your pocket. It's to fund your work. It's just funding for science. Here's some names that just, I don't care if you know these names, but the reason I want to mention them is that they just came off the top of my head, and these names will come up during the term, and you'll say, and they're Canadian. And these are very influential people. Al Bandura from Alberta discovered social learning, you know, learning by imitation. He discovered that scientifically. Endel Tulving is one of the most important psychologists ever, and I'm not pushing anything there. He's at University of Toronto. He's retired now. Important in memory research, really one of the first people to do this. Donald Hebb is probably the most important psychologist of the first half of the 20th century. Montreal. McGill. Brenda Milner, I mentioned. James Mark Baldwin, I mentioned. Gus Craik and Bob Lockhart at U of T wrote the most cited paper in the history of psychology. Okay? Cited meaning like when people write scientific papers, they have to, you don't just make stuff up. You have to actually put references in. You know, just like in the book. When you read the book, there's like a little thing in brackets and it says who did the research. Well, the most cited paper ever is written by Craik and Lockhart. Sarah Shuttleworth is one of the people that started the field of animal cognition. She has 130 scientific publications. And one of her graduate students, who got his PhD in 1993, is standing right here. Bill Roberts, I did a postdoc with Bill, also helped develop animal cognition. Colin McLeod is the world expert on the Stroop effect, which we'll talk about. Al Pavio and Zenon Polishin had a theoretical argument for like 30 years. And they're both at Western, offices across the hall from each other. Pavio believes that we encode things, like when we remember things, an image of it and the word. Polishin doesn't. When I was a psychology club when I was an undergrad at Western, and we tried to get them to have an arm wrestling match to totally solve it, and they wouldn't. And it was because Zenon Polishin said, you know, Al Pavio was Mr. Ontario Bodybuilder 1959. And then I looked at him and went, oh, yes, yeah, Al is big. Brian Colby and Wishaw, huge in the brain area, in neuroscience, very important researchers, coming out of Lethbridge. Vern Honig, and John Stadden, two of the very important people, again, in animal stuff. I think about that. That's when I'm just thinking of random names. What I do. Honig was at Dalhousie, and Stadden's at Duke. The most cited psychology department in the world. So papers, when they're cited, they of course, it always has the author's names, and then it says where they work. So when it says, you know, David R. Broadbent, Algoma University, right? The most cited department in the world, not in Canada, in the world, is the University of Toronto. So we're really good at this. And that's just, again, names. A lot of these people, they're the names I picked are because they're people I know, but they're also, I know they're very influential. It's huge. We're just good at this. If I knew why, I'd sell it. And I'd bottle that ability and sell it, because, I mean, we're very good at it. If you look at, like, who edits journals, it's disproportionately. It's not just, say, We don't just have 10% of what the Americans have. We have 10% of the population, and we have way fewer universities per population. But we have so many people that do these kind of things. It's incredible. We're just good at psychology. So we don't need Canadian editions of books. And you'll see that in other courses. Not they're a bad thing. I decided when we choose these books, why have a Canadian edition? They're all Canadian editions because a lot of the stuff that's mentioned in the book is Canadian. Besides, I think the idea of worrying too much about that's a little silly. All right. Questions about this stuff? Again, don't worry about the names themselves. Just keep them in mind because you will hear about a lot of these people. And you'll read about them in the book. All right. So that's that. That's the history stuff. If you're a psych major, you will, in fact, take a whole course in the history of psychology in fourth year. All right. Keep saying it's the science of behavior and cognition, right? So we're going to talk about what science is and how to think critically a little bit. What is science? There's guys in lab coats. When you think of science, that often comes to mind, right? Guys, and typically, disproportionately, you're going to think men, and it isn't always men. You're going to think about test tubes. I had a lab coat. The reason that those of us who work with animals wear lab coats is because we don't want our clothes to be covered in, you know, bird shit. No, I'm serious. You wear a lab coat because you don't want to get poop on yourself. It was an inspection of our lab when there's these... When you do animal work, your lab gets inspected by government agencies, as it should be. So they come by, and one of the rules always is, you have to wear a lab coat. Silly rule. And once you're any good at handling animals, you don't get pooped on because you know what you're doing. So I hardly ever wore a lab coat. And then we found out when I was in grad school in Sarah's lab, she said, there's going to be an inspection tomorrow. There was two groups. One group did announced inspections. Another group would just show up. They do like snap inspections, right? So we know there's going to be an inspection. So we're told when you come in the morning, go to the coat rack there and grab a lab coat. No one ever wore them. They were just always there. I come in. The only lab coat I could find was about a size, I don't know, it would be like a 38, you know? And I've got big shoulders, big-ish shoulders. I put this thing on and I'm walking like a... So I look like in a mad scientist lab, you know? And I used to have really long hair. I was back in a ponytail and all kind of crazy. And I'm walking around. It was good. One of the inspector guys who I knew actually said, is that your lab coat, Dave? I said, sure it is, Jerry. And he just laughed. But that's what you think of, isn't it? Right? You think of science. You think of that. You don't think of a lot of different things. One of those things makes you go, That really can't be what science is. It's like saying, what's poetry? You know, rhyming stuff. And you know it's not that, right? More than anything, in fact, science is a method of inquiry, or inquiry, depending on how you want to pronounce that. Really, that's what it is. There are many ways to seek the truth, to find out stuff. I got that in quotes, because, you know, it's kind of a lame thing to say. There's something a buddy of mine used to always say, are you still seeking the truth? So, there's a lot of ways to do this. So let's talk about them, and we're going to go sort of historically where they come from, and from the least to the most useful for our purposes for discovering things about cognition and behavior. So the first one is conventional wisdom or common sense. Right? Most people say or think something's true, then you just say it is. Right? Just something you say. This is what gets you through life. General, everyday life. You don't need a series of rigorous experiments to tell you to wear pants. It's just what we do. Right? Everybody does that. Seems sensible, so you do it. A lot of these are sort of put together in old sayings. Things like, I don't know, someone does something, you go, and somebody looks at you and go, yeah, but you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. And I always look at them and go, what's this got to do with horses, man? A rolling stone gathers no moss. What's that mean? That means, you know, if you're always moving around, you're never going to get anything done. Right? Then there's the one that says, idle hands are the devil's playground. Aren't those the opposite? So if you're doing nothing's bad, do something. Oh, but a rolling stone gathers no. Oh, no. So they're always right. There's always a saying for every situation, just like there's always a Star Trek or Simpsons reference or Seinfeld reference for every situation. So it's bizarre because this is like sort of that common sense thing, that sort of, you know, old wives' tales, as people say. They're not very useful in a lot of respects. You can think of things about human behavior, right? You hear people say, well, opposites attract. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. First of all, opposites don't attract, by the way. That's a crock. There's data that shows that's not true. I don't need your fancy science to understand human behavior there, science boy. I know all about human behavior. I'm a human and I think and I behave. Therefore, I am an expert and I don't need your fancy learning from the books. I've heard people say that they don't usually end it with science boy, but you know. I hear people say that a lot. Yeah, psychology, all it is just common sense. It's just common sense. That psychology is just common sense. That's my dumb guy. Remember I told you the other day that you're more likely to help a person in distress if you're by yourself than if you're with a group? Is that common sense? That seems to go against everything that's completely counterintuitive. If I have three lines up, did I tell you about the Ashline? I don't think I tell you about the Ashline experiment. If I have three lines, two of them are the same length, one of them is much shorter, and I ask you which one's the shortest, you're going to be very good at that. Anybody would be. You know, a monkey could do that, like literally. It's easy. But if I have two people in the room that are on my payroll, and you don't know they're on my payroll, and I tell them and they have a prearranged script, and they always pick a different one, you're going to start agreeing with them even though you know you're wrong. And that seems sort of goes against what you would think common sense. You'd say, well, no, I can. It doesn't mean it doesn't change your perception. You can actually still see which one's shortest. It's just you go along with the crowd. Huh. Maybe you do need it. There's just a couple of examples where it's not, conventional wisdom doesn't help you a great deal. You'd be surprised how many times, and you'll find this in the course and in 1107 as well, that what happens, like how human behavior and thinking works and how animal behavior and cognition works, it's a lot different than what we think. We're not very aware of all the unconscious processes that are going on. We don't have access to them by definition. Here's one. We have a lot. Okay. I will grant you, maybe you will say, yeah, sure, there's a lot of these other processes we're not aware of. We've all have a lot of experience with objects in motion, don't we? We are objects, and we often move. So let's see how good you are at physics without knowing any physics. Intuitive physics! Now, don't feel bad. I'm going to do this multiple choice, and I'm going to have you put your hand up and give you different possible answers. These aren't going to be questions with formulas or anything. It's intuitive physics. Who needs science? I have a lot of experience. I didn't go to university. I went to the School of Hard Knocks. They grant degrees. When was that? Anyway. So, here's the first possible example. Pretend, now this is funny because we're going to do a let's pretend. I've got a rope, like a line of some sort, and at the end of it, I've got a weight. And I'm going to spin this over my head. And I'm spinning it, okay? Imagine that. And one of you ungrateful bastards has a machete. Now, you're not going to kill me. Maybe you will after the first test. But right now, you're not going to kill me. You're just going to cut the line. You're going to put that up. It's very sharp, so it's going to... Okay, so you get the scenario. I'm spinning this thing. One of you guys comes up, cuts it. Okay, so now the question is, what way, what direction does the weight go? Does it keep going in a circle? That's option one. And don't put your hand up yet because it's option one. Option two is it goes off like this. So it's spinning like this, and if you cut it here, it's going to go zoo like that, okay? Off to the right, let's say. The final option is it's spinning around, and you cut it right here, it's going to go in a straight line. How many people think it'll keep going in a circle? Put your hand up. Don't feel bad, and don't be influenced. Please put your hand up. Okay, good. How many people think it's going to go like that? How many people think it's going to go in a straight line? That's the right answer, but the number of people that said that is about the same as the people thought it would go off, keep going in a circle. That always reminds me of a joke, and I can make blind jokes because I'm blind. I'm allowed. Right? I don't want you making blind jokes unless you're blind. Or you're a blind parent that you mock a lot, something like that. That's fine. Blind guy goes into a store. He's got his seeing eye dog. Because, you know, they got those dogs. I think technically I could get one, but it's kind of not fair because I'd be taking it from somebody who really needs it. Have it while riding my bike. Picks the dog up by the tail, starts spinning it around. Guy says, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm just looking around." Delayed reaction joke there. That's one of the... Finally getting it. That's interesting. Okay, so that's one. Here's another one. We got guns. Awesome. Perhaps the 50 cal you get, right at level 60 of Call of Duty World at War. No, that's Call of Duty Modern Warfare. Yeah. So anyway, we got two guns. They're hooked up together. One of them's going to shoot a bullet. One's going to shoot a bullet. The other one, actually, they're hooked up, and they're, you know, it's going to drop a bullet. It's just going to drop out of the chamber, and we got it all cleared out, so it's going to hit the ground. Okay? You got the idea then? That's the scenario. We pull the trigger. One bullet's going to go, you know, one of them 50 cal sniper rifles. Those things can shoot 3,000 meters. It's really impressive, right? You know, there's the record for a kill with one of those weapons is like 2,800 meters. It's like from here to my house. I'm just glad I don't know a lot of people that have sniper rifles that hate me. So again, we're going to pull the trigger. What happens? I want to know what bullet hits the ground first. How many people think it's the bullet that is fired from the gun that shoots out? Does it hit the ground first? How many people think it's the bullet that is dropped that's going to hit the ground first? How many people think they're going to hit the ground at the same time? Very good. That is the right answer. Most people get that wrong. Here's another one. It's got a military theme. I like the first-person shooter kind of games. I like those. So I've now got 7 straight kills, so I can call it an airstrike. Some of you guys are getting that, and that's nice. You know, in Modern Warfare, 11 straight kills, you call in an AC-130 gunship. Okay. So you're flying a bomber. You're flying a bomber. And you're going to drop a bomb. Okay. You want to hit the target. You're going, you know, say 500 kilometers an hour. You're booting along. Do you drop your weapon, drop the bomb, before you get over the target, when you're right over the target or past the target? How many people think before you hit the target? How many people think right over the target? How many people think after? Well, that's before. And you'd be surprised how many people, and this has been studied a lot, you get people to come in and do these kind of problems, and the vast majority of people get all three of these things wrong. And we have a lot of experience with objects in motion, so it seems we need fancy-dancy science to do physics. And I mean, that's simple physics. I'm not talking about your, you know, baking black holes like they're doing in Geneva at the Hadron thing. You know, I'm talking about simple things. Here's a good one. This is counterintuitive. I'm going to have to draw a picture for this one. So I'll put the screen up. All right, screen up. Okay. I don't know why I did that. Where the hell's... There's got to be chalk. I thought I saw chalk. Oh, yeah, there's one. Okay, so... Now, I'm going to ask you a question. Sorry, I'm not going to ask you a question. I'm just going to show you this experiment that was done. Okay, that's a glass. This is a line drawing. These experiments are done with line drawings. And here's another glass. And there's the ground, okay, just so you know. Now, groups of first-year university students were asked what, you know, like the line, like, what do they call it? Was that the meniscus? Remember that word? Meniscus. You never get to use it. Meniscus. Sounds good. I had meniscus once. They can treat it outpatient now, though, totally. So it's no problem. It's just some penicillin. Anyway. People were asked to draw what the water would look like in here. And, of course, this one's easy. Everybody gets that one right. Now, males and females, this is cool. All the males got this right. That's how the water would go. It's just gravity and what have you. 30% of the women thought it went like this. Now, and that's a real reliable experiment published in a little journal called Science. It's not like just something I made up. Now you're thinking, wait a second, what? I'm not doing this to trash women. Because that would be stupid, because most of our students are women. And, God, that's annoying, that sound. Oh. Anybody got a can of WD-40 or something? Because we just totally fixed that right now. The reason I bring this up is there's a male-female difference in spatial cognition. Okay, women are different than men, and usually, at how they process spatial things. You can ask women for directions versus men. Men give compass points and distances. Women give landmarks. They both work, by the way. They both work. And it's not that women, when they have a glass that's tilted like this, are going, oh, man, it's magic. I don't think women are stupid. Okay? What I'm saying is that difference is completely counterintuitive, because if I asked you what would happen, everybody would say, well, everybody's going to go dance like that, and they don't. Okay? Now, I could pick one where men look stupid. But I didn't. No, if we could have something about probably grammar or spelling, for example, women are way better at verbal ability than men on average. This is, again, on average. On average, it's not that all men are better than women at this stupid task. It doesn't even matter. What's interesting about it is, in fact, that the difference even shows up. Right? It does, like I said, it doesn't mean that women are constantly amazed by spatial arrangements of things. But there's a lot of data, again, as I said, on how women and men navigate, and it's different. That women talk about landmarks, and men say, go that way. You know, go towards, say, some street, they might say, but they might use just a compass direction, so many kilometers. Women will say, well, first you get to this gas station, you know, and it's a Shell. I mean, you get to the Shell gas station, turn towards, men will always go turn left, turn right. Women will say, well, turn towards the Canadian Tire. That works, by the way. There's nothing wrong with directions like that at all. They work just fine. But it's an interesting difference. Does that, would conventional wisdom say that women would do that with the glass and men wouldn't? Hell no. Of course it wouldn't. Here's one you hear a lot. Crime is increasing, especially violent crime. No, it isn't. You can look at data from the FBI, from the RCMP. Crime has been on the decrease since 1960. Since 1960. Wow, really? Yes. Fear of crime is up. Fear of crime is up. Yeah. So crime's at an all-time low, but fear of crime's at an all-time high. Why is that? Well, you know, we got like channels that have to fill things in now. Right? I have like 5 all-news channels at home. On the internet, you know, you could look up CNN, you could look up CBC, whatever. There's so much information. They have to fill, they have to have content. I'm not blaming the media. I'm not that, I don't do that. I like to blame the media blamers whenever possible. But crime is actually, literally, even especially violent crime, is going down all over the Western world. Wow. Yeah, but fear of crime is up, which is interesting. But, I mean, that really shouldn't be a problem. It's more like, why is the fear there? But, I mean, it's like, you know, zombie attacks are at an all-time low, but fear of zombies is at an all-time high. It's not like we put any credence in that. Here's one that no one, I hope, believes. The world's flat. Or, as Christopher Columbus said in the cartoon with Bugs Bunny, the world, she's a flat. By the way, Christopher Columbus did not sail to the New World to prove the world was round. A high school teacher that wrote a history textbook in about 1911 just put that in. Columbus knew the world. Columbus wasn't an idiot. It wasn't like, if he actually thought the world was flat, do you think he would have gotten a boat going, I'm going to keep going? No. He knew the world was round. And everyone knew, anyone with an education knew the world was round going back to the ancient Egyptians. They really did. Okay? Going way back to them. Anybody, any culture that sailed at all knew. Because they watched. When boats disappeared off the horizon, now, so your average dumb guy goes, it fell off the earth. But then when they come back the next day, or, you know, not the next day, a couple weeks later, after they've gone, say, fishing or whatever, it's pretty clear that they haven't fallen off. And like I said, the ancient Egyptians worked out the math for the world being round. Greeks knew it. Romans knew it. It's not like anybody. Uneducated people thought the world was flat. There still are some people literally that think the world's flat. There really is a flat earth society. These people are idiots. Like, completely, they're just like batshit crazy. One of the four corners of the world, by the way, according to these guys, is Twillingate, Newfoundland. It's true. So if you're ever out in Twillingate looking at whales, keep your eye out also for the dragons at the end of the world. We used to think that, though, the average person, not not people with educations. You got to understand that. People that sailed at all knew the world wasn't flat. No one, you know. It's a conventional wisdom or common sense, except for things like I should wear pants today because, you know, I'm going outside. It's not actually that useful. It's useful, you know, for some things, right? It's like I said, I guess you'd wear pants. When someone says to you, and I've seen a lot of you guys that, you know, my friend of town and that, and you're going down to the bus stop, and I've heard you ask people that clearly you see that are upper year students and that, and you say, when's the bus come? They don't, typically you're going to just trust them. They don't say, oh, get on the Sioux College bus. They say, you want to go downtown, get on the second line bus, right? Oh, and it comes at about 25 after and 5 after. People don't lie to you about those things, but you can do that, and it's fun. But conventional wisdom doesn't help us a great deal. It's too bad, but the nice thing is here, I hope I've shown you that the use of this is useless in a lot of places, but the whole notion that psychology is just common sense is dumb. Let's speak of religion. Let's speak delicately of religion so I don't offend anybody. I'm talking of it, by the way, as a way to seek the truth. I'm not. Because to look for scientific truths. And it doesn't help you there. I am not talking. I have my own personal beliefs about this that we needn't get into. Religion is belief based on faith, right? Is that right? I'm not religious, but is that people that are religious? Is that a pretty good way in general? Yeah, that's good, eh? Yeah. You don't, you know, it seems to be designed for dealing with the metaphysical. Metaphysical, above the physical. Why are we here? What does it all mean? Those kind of questions. Right? A lot of religions Now, I'm not religious, but I know a bit about them because when I was in, did you ever Reach for the Top? Remember that show with the high schools competing? Yeah, I was captain of my team. I was a loser, and I had to know world religion. So, and it seemed to me that one of the things here is they were always pretty common thing is what happens after we die? Those kind of questions. You know, why are we here? Where do we come from? Seems like there's a lot paid attention to in religion about that kind of stuff, which is fine. It's about metaphysical stuff. It's above the physical. It's not the here and now so much. Right? One doesn't usually believe in God because of some bit of evidence or rigorous experimentation. Right? You don't hear people that believe in God or gods saying, well, yeah, I proved it to myself last night. It was a pretty cool experiment. So I ran this experiment, and then it was God. No. People believe in God because they believe in God. It's faith, right? It's called faith for a reason. That's typical, I think. You know, I don't think people... You believe in because you do. There's an expression called leap of faith, isn't there? There's also an achievement you can get in Assassin's Creed called Leap of Faith if you jump 50 times off one of those towers. I'm such an achievement whore. That's why I buy games now. It's sad. NHL 10 is hard. God, it's hard. I went home early to play yesterday because it came out yesterday. It's hard. The only team I can beat so far is Toronto. And I'm dead serious. It's sad, really. It's called faith for a reason, as I said. Right? It's faith. It's not called science. It's called faith. Okay. That's good. So is that, again, for the religious people, does that, am I making sense? Is that pretty much, I hope? So it's not going to help us a whole lot with why people do what they do, except it might say things like, you might have a religion say things like, would you be satisfied with an explanation that a supernatural entity made you do something? Would that satisfy your curiosity? It's not a very good explanation. And if you believe in stuff like that, maybe it's even true for you. But it's not going to satisfy that, because it's like, because that's always the same explanation. Why did so-and-so do this? Devil. Why'd that guy do that? God. You got two explanations. You got devil, you got God. Or maybe you multi-theistic religion. So you got a bunch of gods. Is this God, that God? I think most of us, even the religious among us, wouldn't be horribly happy with that as an explanation for behavior. Right? So it doesn't really help us a great deal. Right? Doesn't help. So let's talk about law. The law. Ding, ding. There's Law and Order there I was doing? Okay. This is getting at the truth based on the presentation of evidence. That sounds kind of science-y, doesn't it? It sounds a little science-y. There's not a court of science. Too bad there isn't. That'd be fun. Your Honor, I object to that graph. But I thought that was funny. I guess apparently no. Your Honor, I'd like that last remark stricken from the record. Okay, see, I thought that was funny. Okay, what's wrong with you people? Okay. That's kind of what we do in science, right? We publish articles and we present our evidence and people make, it sounds kind of good. Here's the problem. Not all evidence is admissible. Right? You've all watched the Law and Order. You've seen the, because you can't help it. Because it's the only thing on TV besides CSI. And now that NCIS show has two versions. This is a new thing now. They're just going to have new versions everywhere. Have I shown you my impression yet of David Caruso? The guy on CIS Miami? You know, the red-haired guy that used to be on NYPD Blue? It's like this. Are you okay? That's all he does. He did that in NYPD Blue as well. Quite an actor. Not all evidence is admissible because maybe they get it illegally. Right? It's like probable cause. Yeah? Like if a cop stops you for not having your seatbelt on, they can't look in your glove box. Right? They can't look in your glove box. If they smell weed in the car, they can look in your glove box. But they typically can't look in your glove box, can they? And if they did, now if you freely open up the glove box and the cop sees like 8 ounces of pot, yeah, you're going to get a little rap on the knuckles. Or in the States, you get hung, I believe. I think they kill you for that. They go right to Gitmo. But if they can't, if they open it, you say, I'd like to see a search warrant. That you try that, by the way. That'll work. That'll be great. They love that. That's cops' favorite thing ever. But if they did get it that way and then they took you in, the evidence would probably be, if you had a halfway decent lawyer, it would be inadmissible, right? Because they had no reason to look in your glove box. It doesn't work that way in science. It's like, well, I don't want to tell anybody about these results. You can't do that. So I think people probably do. But eventually they kind of get caught. The system kind of corrects itself. Fairness is supposed to be the key thing in justice, right? That's why we say innocent until proved guilty. Right? Nobody's ever found innocent, though. They're found not guilty, which is actually kind of similar to the kind of decisions we make in science, which is, you know, either we reject the hypothesis or we don't. It's kind of similar that way. It's kind of cool. But we're trying to be fair, so we don't say prove that you're innocent. Hard to do. Hard to do. They have to prove you're guilty. We're trying to be fair. I know the justice system isn't always fair. Right? It's fairer than it used to be, but it isn't completely fair. Of course not. It's an imperfect thing. Yeah. What are questions? No, I don't have a question. Okay. It's better than it was. The system's weighted, in fact, so that it's not like the jury or the judge has to go, I think he probably did it. It's got to be beyond a reasonable doubt, right? So it's weighted. The system's weighted, and it's weighted, and as a society, have decided that it's probably better to let the odd bad person free than it is to convict someone who didn't do something. Now, I know those things happen. The difference here, though, is sometimes your defense is as good as your lawyer. O.J. Simpson killed his wife. I mean, I'm sorry. But he had an awesome lawyer. Lawyers, but Johnny Cochran was amazing. And the other thing was, the prosecution were horrible. They were horrible. Most of you guys were watching a lot of TV at that point, or if you were, it was like the freaking Teletubbies. But you looked at it, you went, okay, oh, let's see, his blood's everywhere, all this stuff looked pretty clear, except that I remember watching this thing thinking, oh, if I was in the jury, I'd say not guilty, because they haven't convinced me, even though I'm sure he did it, because it's his blood everywhere, and he had a knife, and yada, yada, yada. But they had enough reasonable doubt, and that's how the system's supposed to work. Right? Because he had a good lawyer, he ends up getting off. Wow. But our society's determined that's an okay thing. We've determined that to try to be fair. Laws are based on what society sees as fair, society through their elected representatives. Our representatives can change laws. That's what they do. That's what the legal people, that's what the MPs and the Congress people, if you live in the States or whatever, that's what they do. They make laws. You can think of all kinds of possible examples. At one time, and this was not too long ago, 20 years ago, it was perfectly fine to smoke in public buildings. You smoke in the mall. That was only 15 years ago, 12 years ago. People used to smoke in grocery stores. I always thought it was kind of gross. But people always smoked in universities. It was what people did. There was a smoke break during class. Yeah. You go out in the ashtrays. It's true. It used to be fine. People did that. Right? People thought that was perfectly acceptable behavior. When I was an undergraduate at Western in the mid-80s, you would, of course, you go to the library. You were not allowed to bring food in. Like, you're still not, right? Always this little sign, no food. But there was a smoking section. Because as we know, fire is great around books. So there were, like, study carrels. Like, you know, they have in the library downstairs, like, little study carrels. And some of them had built-in ashtrays. World's changed. Because society decided, you know, we're not big up on the smoking. And now if you say the word cigarette in public, you're worse than Hitler. But society decided it wasn't good. We made laws, and now it's changed. We've just changed the rules. Right? You know, they just decided it was no longer good for people to smoke in public, so you're not allowed to anymore. They're making a law now, a bylaw in the city, you can't smoke in a park. Apparently, it's okay to breathe in the fumes from a steel plant. It just seems a little bit much for me. Try doing that, we'll say, oh, I don't know, Newton's second law. Force is no longer equal to mass times acceleration. The Ontario legislature now says it's equal to mass times acceleration plus 4. Won't work. You can say that all you want. It doesn't change the scientific law. Right? You can't do that with science. So, see, this is where it does get different. Besides the thing being weighted and fairness, trying to be fair and all that, we can't change scientific laws. We can make discoveries that make us change the way we think about some scientific laws. That we can do. But we cannot, like I said, we can't change a law. We can't change Newton's three laws. You just can't do it. Reaction has an equal and opposite reaction, except on Thursday. You can't do that. Right? So it's got some similarities. Now, the scientific method, it's the most recent one of these, right? Because you could say that common sense was as soon as there were, you know, people kind of stood up and went, huh? There was common sense. And then there was, religion was invented. It's pretty clear that there was like ceremonial burial of people and stuff like that going back more than 15,000 years. Okay? The first written down code of laws, somewhere between 4,000 and 6,000 years ago. Science is newer, 1600s. Okay? So science has had the advantage of being able to take little bits and pieces from each of them. Right? And it's used for a certain set of problems and for some specific reasons. Really started in the 1600s or so with Newton and Bacon. You ever had Fig Newtons and Bacon? Oh, baby. Thank me later. So Newton, Bacon, people like this. Okay. You can see this is pretty recent. So what are some characteristics of scientific thinking? One of them is empiricism. Empiricism. That means you trust your senses and you do direct observation and experimentation. Experimentation means changing something and then looking and seeing what happens, basically. And you directly observe stuff. You don't trust others' judgment. You trust your own judgment. Okay? Now, you will trust others' judgment when they describe how they did something and say they did it. That's just, you know, nice human quality, rather. But we don't. When someone says, oh, the world works like this, you don't go, oh, okay. You say, I want to see some data to back up that assertion. Try to be objective. So we rely on measurement not on gut feelings. We don't rely on conventional wisdom, for example. We actually look and see what people do in a certain situation. Right? So we never rely, we rely just on measurement. And a measurement can be done with a measuring tape, and it can be done with a stopwatch, but it also is done with things like IQ tests. We have carefully controlled measurement because we don't want to bring bias into the situation. Now, you think bias with a stopwatch? No. Bias with a pencil and paper test? Yeah, that can happen. I remember in a second year personality class that I took, our prof telling us this story and also showing us a film, actually, not a video, but a film, of inner city African-American kids in the 60s who were being tested on IQ tests. IQ tests developed by white people for white upper middle class people. Who they developed them on? University students. Okay. So they're testing these kids and they're asking them questions and the kids are giving culturally relevant answers that are being marked as wrong. These are mid to late 60s, okay? Now, you got to understand something. Like, you know how now there's, like, pineapples and bananas and oranges always in the store? Those used to be specialty items. And when they came, they were all very often, especially in poorer neighborhoods, not very good fruit. So there's a video of this little 6-year-old African-American boy being asked what color a banana is, which is a great, you know, kind of a kid question. The kid answers, which to him is right, they're brown. Because that's what he's seen. 12-year-old boy is asked, is it better to pay for something with cash or with a check? Now, the correct answer is a check, because you can balance your checkbook, keep track of your money. Today we might say debit card. That's what's given as the correct answer. But see, when you're a poor kid, the correct answer is cash, because checks bounce. So there were all these kids, predominantly African-American kids in the States, that were scoring as being literally profoundly retarded that clearly weren't, and it was because the test was biased. Now, some people didn't buy this. They're like, oh, blah, blah, blah. That's what they said. Yeah. So these researchers developed a very cool thing. They developed, I have to write down something on the board to show you this. They developed a test. They're testing my patience with that thing. They developed a test that was about inner city life for African American kids, and it was written in black English. And the test was called the Black Intelligence Test for Cultural Heritage, on which all these white researchers scored as profoundly retarded. Made a very good point. Very good point. And that point is, we have to worry about bias in testing. And it's not just about culture. We have to worry about gender bias, sex bias, that kind of thing, right? So if we've got a lot of questions that, if they're all normalized on little boys are probably more interested in, oh, I don't know, hockey in Canada. Right? So little boys do hockey, and then you ask a little boy, who wore number 99? Every little boy in Canada knows Wayne Gretzky. Little girls might not know that. And now, in Canada, they might. You get outside of Canada, you don't know Wayne Gretzky wore 99. What are you, retarded? No, that's the kind of the way these tests were working, right? They were perfectly sensible tests for the group they were developed for. For the group they were developed for. But I like leaving that on the board for the next person. I do. I leave the thing down and then they come in and it's awesome. So the point is, we have to have, now the IQ tests have actually gotten a whole lot better, because this really made a nice point. It made this great point to people, and they changed a lot of the tests, and tests are pretty good now. Tests are pretty good now. Right? So we can't have bias in our measurement. Now, on the other hand, now let's say we have a good unbiased instrument and then something comes up we don't like. Too bad. So if we get the result that women think that the liquid's on the side, that makes us feel a little creepy because that doesn't fit with our nice liberal politics. We don't care. We have to tell people. Right? So you take your results at face value. You don't just reject them out of hand because it doesn't seem right to you. I don't care how it seems to anybody. Questions about that so far? Just a couple more minutes here and we'll be done. All right. Testability. Things have to be testable. A guy named Karl Popper, there he is. Now, he looks like a nice guy, but he looks like he'd also, if he got mad at you, he'd just snap you in two. Something about him. He's a philosopher of science. And he had what he called the falsifiability principle. And what he said was predictions drawn from a theory must be specific enough to allow the theory to be shown to be incorrect. Ooh, that's good. Say that again. Predictions drawn from a theory must be specific enough to allow the theory to be shown to be incorrect. You have to be able to prove it's wrong. See? Incorrect. We actually don't prove theories. We disprove theories, and eventually the only thing left standing is the thing is probably true. That's kind of cool. So, like, okay, here's why Freud isn't a scientific theory. I'm going to ask you a question. I don't want you to answer it because it's a weird personal question, but it's a question for the guys. How many people here want to have sex with their mother? Don't answer the question, please, because I don't want to know. Because if you do, I'll have to call the police. But if that is correct, if you answer yes, my theory is correct. Oh, yeah. If you answer no, you know what my answer is? You're repressing. My theory is correct. Oh, yeah. No matter what you say, I'm right. Oh, I see. It can't be shown to be incorrect, can it? Because if everything you say, I say, proves my theory. That's what I predicted. Then it's useless. So it's no longer a scientific theory. It's a theory. It's a theory. So is the thing about the moon landing being a hoax a theory. It's stupid. So predictions drawn for theory must be specific enough to allow the theory to be shown to be incorrect. This is why science doesn't do things like, remember the Simpsons episode where Homer has the crayon and he pulls it out of his nose because Lisa stuck a crayon up his nose when she was really little and he didn't know it. Pulls it out and he becomes really smart because it was damaging his brain. And then Homer does a mathematical proof of why there's no God. Have you seen that episode? And even Flanders looks at it and goes, oh my. Science actually can't do that because let's think of it. Let's think of Popper. Could you design an experiment to show that something that was above and beyond the physical and laws of the universe existed or not? Well, no. Because it can control the physical laws of the universe. So science doesn't go around saying, there's no God. Some scientists might, but that's a personal thing. But they don't say, my research clearly shows there's no God. Because they'd look like idiots. Someone says that, you'd say, you could say I'm pretty darn sure there isn't, and yada, yada, yada. But you couldn't do an experiment testing the existence of a supernatural entity. You can't do an experiment. One of my favorites is things like this, psychics. You like the psychics? So people say, okay, I'm going to try to do a little psychic reading, and then I try to imagine. Say, oh, my mind's blank. There must be people in here that are unbelievers. Oh. And then I can't do it again, and I keep coming up with excuses. Oh, there's been a lot of interference. There's too many people around. And I go on and on and on. And we, of course, finally get down to the point where eventually I can guess your card and go, yeah, it worked. Well, see, I can't show it incorrect because every time you always have an excuse. Science can't deal with things that have excuses, basically. I like that. All right. Questions? See you Monday. Thanks, guys. By the way, that clock's wrong. Don't think you're late for your next class.
It's off by like 10 minutes.
This podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright share alike 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.